Hi.
Hold on. I have to introduce you. So it's my pleasure now to introduce Maria Arias, who'll be speaking about Unshocked, Ejecta, and Casse and Tycho. Maria, this is a 15-minute talk. I'll give you a 5-minute warning. Please go ahead.
Thank you. Thank you for introducing me. Thank you to the organizers for making sure that the conference happened twice during my PhD. And thank you, Brian, for the introduction. I'm going to talk about some of the research I've done on young supernova remnants with the LOFAR radio telescope. So the LOFAR telescope is an interferometer based in the Netherlands. It covers these very low radio frequencies just before the ionospheric cutoff of the radio window. And it's a good instrument for supernova remnant studies because it combines sensitivity and angular resolution because it probes a wide variety of baselines. Okay, so Brian said this, we all know it. At the time of the explosion, some mass is ejected with some kinetic energy. The blast wave moves faster than the speed of sound in the ISM. A shock forms, material is swept up and heated. As the ISM material is swept up, ejecta run into each other at the boundary, and a reverse shock is formed. The reverse shock heats the ballistically expanding internal ejecta that it encounters and heats them again to X-ray emitting temperatures. This material is what I'm concerned with in my research, the unshocked ejecta. And it was originally heated by the passage of the blast wave, but since then the remnant expanded adiabatically and the unshocked ejecta cooled. In young remnants, the reverse shock might still not have heated all of the internal ejecta, and there can be a reservoir of cold material interior to the shell because the shell is emitting very bright in X-rays and likely also UV radiation. They can be photoionized. So the unshocked ejecta are interesting because they're pristine in a sense that they haven't interacted with the interstellar medium yet, and so they can be interesting for the physics of the explosion, but they're difficult to probe. One of them is the decay of radioactive elements. As Brian said, it doesn't depend whether titanium-44 decays, it doesn't depend on whether the material has been shock heated or not, so we can still see it from inside the reverse shock. There's also, as I said, the material is photoionized, so there can be infrared and near-infrared transitions that we see. And then finally, there can be coal dust mixed with the unshocked ejecta. And this is a very active area of research that we'll be hearing more later in the session, but it can also offer us some insight on the conditions inside the reverse shock. And then the last method that we have of detecting the unshocked ejecta is from low frequency radio absorption. So our work is based on the observation that free absorption from ionized material along the line of sight starts to really kick in at low far frequencies. This can be from the ISM, but it can also be from this cold material interior to the shell of the remnant. And if it's from the interior material, there's a part of the shell on the front side that will never be absorbed by this material. So in order to tell these two effects apart, we need broad bandwidth, and we need many narrowband images. For making many images of narrowband, of course, we need very bright sources, which is why I've done this study on Casse and on Tycho. Okay, so Casse is a 350-year-old supernova remnant, so it's still in this early phase of the evolution where the reverse shock is actively encountering internal ejecta. We saw that in Rob Thiessen's talk the first day. And this is work that I did in 2018. I was in high school in 2008. And that I recently revisited because I was going back on this method for Tycho, and then in the intervening time, my collaborator had finished his LOFAR LBA data reduction pipeline, so we used the entire observation. Initially, I'd only used a tenth of it for my analysis. So we have a different mass estimate. I have an update to present on this work. Roughly what I did is I made a gallery of narrowband images, including some higher frequency images that I got from other people, and then fit it for this equation, which has a strong dependency on the frequency through the optical depth. So internal absorption has this characteristic shape because the front side of the shell is never absorbed. So what my fit did for each pixel is find an amplitude. This term F, that has to do with how much the material is subject to internal absorption versus not subject to internal absorption, so how much comes from the front versus the backside of the shell. And then the optical depth we fit for a parameter that's a combination of Z, the number of ionizations, the temperature, and the emission measure. These are the results of our fit. So this first panel is the deviation from power law. So for each pixel, how different from the normal synchrotron power law behavior of the source the measurement is. This term F is how much of the material is absorbed versus unabsorbed. So where F is equal to 1, all of the material comes from the front side of the shell, which means that there's no internal absorption. Where F is different from 1, some of the material comes from the back side of the shell. So this is a way of actually probing the regions of unshocked material, and you can see that it roughly describes the outline of the reverse shock. The third one is how much absorption, what the luminosity would be, well, the flux density would be if there was no absorption. And then the last one is an emission measure. To get here, we have to assume certain temperature and ionization conditions, and actually is very degenerate with F. And as I was revisiting my work, I found that some of the pixels were disproportionately contributing to the mass estimate. So I've done that differently this time around, which is also why I have a different estimate of the unshocked mass. Okay. So the point that I want to drive home is that the mass is a function of a lot of things that we don't know. The emission measure depends on the temperature. We had originally assumed 100 Kelvin, and then there was a paper by Raymond and collaborators that found that that was indeed the temperature in the unshocked ejecta, although they also note that there are regions of higher temperature within the reverse shock. Z is the number of charges. We see low ionization species in the unshocked ejecta of Cas A, so silicon, oxygen, sulfur. Of course, the mass is directly proportionate to the mass number of the ions that form the unshocked ejecta. We know there's silicon, there's oxygen, there's sulfur, and it's also been proposed that there is iron. And finally, this L has to do with the depth of the absorbing material. So what is the geometry of the unshocked ejecta? And this is actually something that's not very straightforward. These 2010 papers, we also saw some of the results earlier today, they argue that the unshocked ejecta is in these two thick disks, and in fact they predict that Cas A's synchrotron rate is going to increase over the next century as these are heated by the reverse shock. And this is the geometry that we assumed in our 2018 paper. We've seen this like in every talk about Cas A so far, but I don't think anyone's shown that inside of the reverse shock, they also see the structure of the material. And they argue that these are bubbles from radioactive elements, and the material is pushed outside on these rims of the bubbles. And then finally, the unshocked ejecta can be directly imaged. This was done last year by Kuo and collaborators. And they found a diffuse emission with clumps, filaments, and arches. And their filter has these two lines, but they actually argue that it's neutral silicon that we're seeing here. And I was very happy when I superimposed their contours on our power law deviation map, because they pretty much match. Their big clumps coincide with clumps where we see high values of power law deviation, although we have some clumps that don't seem to have neutral silicon counterpart. Okay, so this is the new mass estimate. It's 0.53 solar masses, different from the three solar masses that I argued previously, but it's a mass estimate that comes with a lot of caveats. One of them is that we don't know the composition. I took it to be oxygen, which is the lightest element, but actually there's silicon sulfur, and there could be iron. So depending on the proportion of these species, the mass estimate can increase. Then there's the issue of the temperature, which is probably okay. The this L, the depth of the absorbing material, we took the thickness of the thick disks, but actually Milisavljevic Fitch and FISN have lines of sight that are thicker and thinner, and depending on how this aligns with our regions of absorption, it can very much alter the mass estimate. And then the number of ionizations. We took three ionizations because the mass estimate was so high to begin with, but actually most of the detected lines are of lower ionizations, and the neutrals are not even factored in our mass estimate. Our mass estimate is only sensitive to ionized material. And then there's finally the effect of clumping. We saw on the first day that the clumps of material that are encountered in the reverse shock are very small and very dense, and this can you can have similar amounts of absorption for much less mass if the mass is clumped. So the estimate can be wrong in both directions, and wildly so. So rather than taking it as a firm estimate of the mass, it's a probe into the unshocked in the conditions of the unshocked ejecta that we have to combine with lots of other observables. Okay, so I recently came back to this topic of young supernova remnants and their unshocked ejecta with Tycho. Tycho was a good candidate for this kind of work because it's bright, it's northern, and it's young, but it also doesn't have much mass that can be unabsorbed because it's a type 1A explosion. So this is what it looks like in the LOFAR LBA. I also made a gallery of images, of which I'm only showing you two. And then this is just a few quality tests. The HBA map at 143 megahertz looks very similar to the VLA map at 1.4 gigahertz. This is spectral index map, one decade in frequency, and there's no major features. The flux densities measured from LOFAR that I took are here, these blue points. They're very much in line with what we expected, so I'm confident about the flux calibration. And these are the results of the fit. So in this case, for each pixel, I fit it for an amplitude, the term F, spectral index, which I didn't take as a given, which I did in CASE, internal absorption, and absorption from ionized material in the ISM. So here you can see that we can roughly recover also the rim of the reverse shock, and it matches, if I put a circle here around these features, it matches what the reverse shock measurement is from X-ray methods. And what I wanted to say is that there are regions like here with a very high spectral index where the fit is unreliable. It's not doing a good job at fitting. But the flux densities look okay, and the general behavior of the fit also seems to be okay. So for this region in the rim, spectral index is what we expect from literature values, and it shows a little bit of absorption from ionized material along the line of sight. This region over here with a higher value of external absorption, you can see we recover an optical depth that's on the high side but still matches what some supernova remnants have. And then this region inside of the reverse shock shows this characteristic internal absorption shape where the higher frequencies and the lower frequencies have a similar spectral index and only a fraction of the emission is absorbed. But I have a problem with this plot, is that I have to invoke a very high value of the absorption for the region, much higher than for CASE. And there's no way that we can reconcile this with a reasonable mass estimate for the unshocked ejecta in Tycho. So even if we take iron, because that's what we expect the unshocked ejecta to be formed of, but even for very low temperatures, we have very unphysical values of the mass. So the way to reconcile this measured value of the absorption with what we know about Tycho has to do with the degree of ionization and the geometry of the material. These are the things that we can tinker with, but still not so much. So for a power law ejecta distribution with these parameters, we get this kind of, if we measure the forward shock from the literature, the reverse shock from our measurements, we get a particular value of the unshocked ejecta mass depending on the explosion energy and the parameter. So it should be around 0.3 solar masses, which means that maybe this isn't the this isn't what the ejecta inside of Tycho looks like. And I was very, I didn't know about the SATO results until earlier on this talk. And I was very happy to hear that they also favor a very clumpy ejecta distribution, because that's, a clumping really would be able to account for a large part of this unshocked, of this emission measure without much mass. If the interior is also foamy, in the sense that it has this radioactive bubble that pushes the material out of the side, it would also help. Another thing that we can invoke is very high ionizations, but it's difficult to have these very high ionizations in cold material. And it's also possible that Tycho is ionizing the medium around it, and our fit isn't separating both contributions properly, but the fit really has that characteristic shape that we would expect. So I would be happy to hear if you have any questions, comments, and thank you for listening.
Very well, so now questions. Oh, Bill has his hand up right away.
Thanks. Just related to your last point about Tycho, the possibility that it's ionizing the region around it, the hydrogen Balmer filaments that bound at least one side, and if you go faint enough, almost all the way around, requires neutral material that the shock is encountering. So you can at least answer that one question is no, it's not ionizing the area around it, or we wouldn't see that optical emission.
But it could be material that's a little bit further away that's not directly interacting with the shock, but is at some distance, and just the radiation from Tycho ionizes the shock.
Well, the implication of the Balmer filaments is that as the shock is moving out, it is continuing to encounter partially neutral material.
Okay.
That's where the filaments come from. So
even if it's at some healthier distance, it wouldn't work.
So you'd have to ionize the stuff out there without ionizing the stuff near to the shock.
Of course,
so
yeah.
That's.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, question over here from here.
So thank you very much for your very interesting talk. So probably you already explained, but could you explain once more why you could evaluate the unshocked mass well for Cassiopeia A, while mass estimation was not so good for Tycho? Which condition is so critical?
Well. Let me see. The CASE observation is probably a better data set. It has a higher exposure time. We started from a better calibration model. The data itself might be more reliable. The one in Tycho might have very large error bars. But on the other hand, I don't really understand the Tycho results very well. I'm still not sure what's the effect of the systematics, but the flux calibration looks good. And the fit does generally what we expect in the rest of the source. So I don't really know how to, of course, I understand that part of the reason that the emission measure value is so high is that there's something wrong with the way that I've done my data reduction or the analysis, but I'm not able to tell you where I've looked at the things where I would expect it to go wrong. Like, of course, it's noisier data, the error bars are larger, but I'm not sure.
Okay, thank you. Thank you very much.
Okay, and yep, I see you.
So how do you square the new Cassiopeia A ejector mass with the dust mass estimates for the unshocked ejector? Because it looks like the new values are basically the same. So that would be a dust to gas mass ratio of 1, which seems kind of high.
This is the mass that we measure. And
yep, fair enough.
I don't know what they do for determining the mass in dust. I don't know how reliable that estimate is. Also, I pointed out there's numerous assumptions that go into the valuing the unshocked mass. So in a way, you can make it your preferred number. But in any case, it's possible that this estimate is on the high side, because it's likely that the ejecta are clumped, and that's going to lower the estimate. So I guess that only makes the problem worse.
Okay, thanks.
Yes, please.
Well, this is This is great stuff. It's a real pleasure to see radio astronomy playing such an important part in the meeting, which it hasn't so far. On CASA, there's a lot of interest in how much unshocked iron in particular there could be. Have you all tried to see how far you could push it? Your technique has an advantage. You might, the iron 2 images might not show everything if some of it's been ionized iron 3 or something like that, but you should see it all. Can you use your number to get an upper limit? If you pushed everything, how much unshocked iron could there be?
Are there reliable estimates of how much of the other elements there are? Because that would be, I guess what we could do is take an ionized iron map and see how it matches our features and maybe derive some properties about the size of these clumps. But I don't know that we would be able to, we would be sensitive to all the ionized iron, so nothing neutral. And then it would be hard to disentangle the contributions from all the other elements because right. We're just sensitive to the ionized material. So I guess we would have to find if there are regions where we see absorption where there's neither silicon, oxygen, or sulfur, and then we could guess that that's iron. So that would might be a way to go on about it, but I don't know if there are maps as like the KU 2018 silicon map that are comparable in other infrared lines of other elements. But this would be something that we could look into.
Yes, Steve, excellent question. The amount and distribution of iron is a critical parameter in simulations like ANUP and Tomas has been speaking about, and this is something where JDOST hopefully can shed additional light on. And Maria, thank you. This is very important and very challenging work to be done, so we look forward to watch it. All right, let's thank her again.